You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped. Streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. My guest today is Ambassador Susan Rice. She served for 8 years during the Clinton administration, including as the youngest Assistant Secretary of State in the history of the State Department. Later, she returned to the White House as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and the National Security Advisor to President Obama. Susan Rice has been at the table during the most pressing international crises of the past 30 years, and along the way, she's encountered her fair share of controversy and conspiracy theories. Now she writes about all that and much more in her new memoir titled Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. And today, Ambassador Rice joins me on the podcast to talk about her family's unique American story and how playing peacekeeper during her parents' troubled marriage made her grow up fast, but it also gave her an early crash course in diplomacy. She talks about her baptism of fire when she joined the Clinton administration and immediately got thrown in the deep end with back-to-back crises in Somalia and Rwanda. She describes the U.S. Embassy bombings in 1998 as the hardest day of her career. Talks about her contentious relationship with Ambassador Richard Holbrooke and how she got roped into taking the hit for the Obama White House following the 2012 attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya. Plus, she speculates on what might have motivated President Trump to suddenly pull out of northern Syria. She says Vladimir Putin is a creep and a pig, and she talks about her famous moves on the dance floor. Coming up with Ambassador Susan Rice in just a moment. Susan Rice was National Security Advisor and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations under President Barack Obama. Previously, during the Clinton administration, she served on the National Security Council as Director for International Organizations and Peacekeeping, then Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for African Affairs, before becoming Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador Rice is currently a Distinguished Visiting Research Fellow at the School of International Service at American University, a non-resident fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Now Susan Rice is out with a compelling new memoir titled Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Ambassador Rice, welcome.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be with you.
Well, I'm just going to start with what I think everyone probably wants to know. You served two different presidents over, I want to say, probably about a collective 16 years. Have you at any point in your career ever thought that you might have to file a whistleblower report on your commander-in-chief?
No.
No? Not even close?
No, fortunately.
Okay.
Not even close.
Well, let me ask you, does President Trump's Ukraine scheme now make you possibly question all the other weird and inexplicable moves that he's made, oftentimes seemingly out of the blue and without any prior knowledge from his own advisors?
Well, I think, Ben, Ukraine, northern Syria, his comments inviting China to interfere in our elections are really just the most recent and obvious manifestations that something is really wrong. Mm-hmm. And there are many different policy decisions, moves, statements that the president has made that clearly don't accord with the national interest, that seemingly have no explanation. Why is so much of what he does beneficial to Putin and Russia and run directly counter to U.S. interests? Syria is a very, you know, proximate example, but so is Ukraine. Why is it that we have a president who denigrates the institutions of the United States, whether it's the intelligence community or law enforcement, Congress, the courts, the press, and lifts up, you know, those of the autocrats, and behaves in autocratic ways? Something is amiss here, and it's more than Donald Trump's temperament. It's more than, you know, what he purports to be an America first foreign policy. It all boils down to a me first approach to governing, where he's using the office for his own personal political or perhaps financial benefit, and he's doing it to the detriment of our national cohesion, our democracy, and our global leadership. And so, you know, nobody yet has all the evidence that connects the dots, but what is clear is that Trump is transactional. His transactions are to benefit himself, not the United States. And yes, we should be questioning every single one of these seemingly inexplicable choices or decisions that the president has made along the way that just don't add up. We don't have a president who seems to be about serving the United States. Instead, he seems to be about undermining it. And there's something, you know, grotesquely wrong with that that we all need to understand and deal with.
But please, let's talk about Benghazi and Obama's tan suit. That's what really matters, doesn't it?
Exactly, especially the tan suit.
Do you ever sit there and just wonder how much flack President Obama would have gotten over just an average day in the Trump White House?
I mean, you try not to lose your mind by thinking the obvious thought, like, what the hell would they be saying if Obama had done this? But I confess, I think every day. It's just, you know, Obama got criticized for waking up in the morning. And yet, you know, Trump's misogyny and his attacks on women and all these things that, you know, we continue to see below the fold on the, you know, the inside of the paper, which in the grand scheme, you know, ought to be huge issues or scandals and get relegated to ho-hum. It's really quite extraordinary. And what's worse about it is, in my opinion, the hypocrisy of Republican leadership in Congress, which would not miss an opportunity to make a big deal out of completely little stuff, but now have lost their guts or their principles or both.
Yeah.
Because they've blown all the standards away. And now, you know, even fundamental stuff like the notion that the executive branch needs to comply with congressional subpoenas, it would never have occurred to us, you know, to defy writ large subpoenas across the board.
Yeah.
Or any prior administration, not just the Obama administration, Republican or Democrat, that we would never have done that. Now Congress is essentially validating the executive branch's trashing of the... you know, of the Article One institution.
Yeah, it's hard for me to listen to anyone who carries one of these pocket constitutions in their in their back pocket.
The pious defenders, but, which we all ought to be.
Yeah. When you were UN ambassador under Obama, you had to do quite a lot of heavy lifting early on in terms of mending bridges with other nations after the war in Iraq. How much harder is that job going to be this time around? And what kind of advice would you give to the next president?
The next president or the next UN ambassador or both?
Both.
Okay. Well, the UN ambassador obviously is playing a role that's an extension of the policies of a new president or next president. It's going to be so much harder. I mean, frankly, when I became UN ambassador, as I write about in Tough Love in 2009, there was some repair work to do. John Bolton was my predecessor once removed. He'd broken a huge amount of crockery in New York. The decision to go to war with Iraq without UN authorization And to trash many of our allies in Europe as, you know, chocolate eaters, old school, not worthy, all that stuff,
freedom fries. Yeah.
You know, that had a lingering effect. And so there was some repair work to do, and particularly to show that we cared about the institution of the United Nations and were prepared to cooperate and roll up our sleeves. But it was nothing like what we're facing now. Those were policy differences and differences of approach. But we weren't facing a prior administration that had literally blown up all the rules and norms and arrogated to themselves the authority of the office for the personal political benefit of a president. Each one of the prior administrations, both President Bush's administrations, Clinton, Obama, go all the way back, whether you liked their policies or not, they were doing what they thought was best in the national interest. And that is what's fundamentally different now. So when a new president, knock on wood, comes along, he or she is going to have to take extraordinary steps to try to repair the damage. And we have to be sober about this. It's not going to be repaired by the actions of one administration or one president, because what we've said to the world is we're capable of electing somebody who blows up the system. And we're going to have a very hard time convincing the world that we wouldn't do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And what's worse is that the guardrails, particularly in Congress, where the Republicans have put party over country, haven't worked. So when people look at the United States and say, okay, well, they maybe had a whack president, but they have the institutions of separations of power and all this stuff that will keep things on track, and it hasn't worked.
So it's not a case where we can just say Trump was an aberration, trust us again.
Well, we'll say that, and we may believe it, but it'll be hard to convince people of that. So we've got to focus on repairing our relationships, our alliances in particular. We've got to tell the truth and be transparent in how we govern. There are all sorts of things that we have to do to sort of get back to status quo ante, and then be patient and recognize that there's a good reason why countries are going to be slow to buy into where we are and where we say we want to go.
Well, let's talk about this wonderful new memoir, Tough Love. Your relationship with your parents sort of makes up the emotional heart of the book, and you spend a good portion of the book talking about your fascinating family history. Your mom and dad were the products of two very different versions of the Black American experience. Can you talk a little about them and how their backgrounds shaped your own ideas about race and equality in America?
Yeah. Well, my father came from a family that were the descendants of slaves in segregated South Carolina. Mm. He was born around 1920 into the heart of Jim Crow and the most raw excesses of segregation. But he had been the grandson of a slave. And my great-grandfather, Walter Rice, who had been a slave after emancipation, fought in the Union Army and then got a college education, which was extraordinary in that context, and then founded a school in New Jersey called the Bordentown School in the late 1880s, which for 70 years educated generations of African Americans in vocational skills and college preparatory skills.
Wow.
And then, and so my father was, in a long line of educators and ministers. And by the time he came along, he said, I don't want to be a minister. And he became an economist. And that was after he served in World War II at Tuskegee with the Tuskegee Airmen. And that experience really shaped him, because he was very resentful of the fact that African Americans had to prove to white people that they could do the obvious and fly as well as they could, or fight in combat as well as they could. And he resented the notion that he was supposed to serve in a military that was fighting for freedom for everybody but his own people. And he'd go off base to try to get something to eat in a restaurant, and he couldn't be served, but German POWs were being served.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole experience of being diminished and doubted and denigrated shaped him quite profoundly. And yet, he went on to get his PhD in economics. He went on to be a professor of economics at Cornell and to serve at the Treasury Department and the World Bank and in the private banking sector, and ultimately as a governor of the Federal Reserve. And over time, he learned, one, that this still, despite his experiences and that of many other African Americans, is, in his judgment, the best country on the face of the earth. And only in this country could he have achieved what he achieved and passed on those benefits to his children. But he also developed a mindset about race that came from having been the victim of racial oppression that I think enabled him to thrive, and he passed it on to me and my brother. And that is, in short, if my being black is going to be a problem, it's going to be a problem for somebody else, not me. Mm-hmm. In other words, I'm not going to let other people's prejudice get in my head and cause me to diminish my own self-image to cause me to doubt myself.
What was his motto? Don't take any crap.
Don't take like crap off of anyone. That was his whole thing. Book. Don't take crap off anyone. Believe in yourself and push back. Mm-hmm. So that was his experience. My mom was the daughter of immigrants from Jamaica who came to Portland, Maine, of all places, in 1912. They had nothing, janitor and a maid, no education, but they came here for the American dream like so many others. They had five kids, sent them all to college. Two became doctors, one a university president, one an optometrist, and then my mom, who was the baby, who went on to be a leader in the corporate world. And more importantly, she was known as the mother of the Pell Grant program, meaning she helped get college access for 80 million Americans. So on both sides of the family, just sort of this compulsion to rise, determination not to be kept down, and a real commitment to service and about contributing to society in a way that is broader than yourself. And by the time my brother and I came along in the mid-60s, my parents had risen as their parents had, and our experience was far more comfortable than theirs had been. But we were taught that we had to work hard. We had to get an education. We were supposed to excel. And God damn it, you know, we couldn't slack. Yeah. So we had to, do our best. Total tough love. But it made us strong, and it gave us a sense of what we could be.
Mm-hmm. Now, your parents had a troubled marriage and a rather contentious custody battle. You recall having to grow up fast and play sort of peacekeeper between them. It was sort of early preparation for a life in diplomacy.
I had no idea at the time, but you're absolutely right. It was really, their fighting was violent and intense and scary. And I was really 7 years old or about that age when I had a consciousness of what was going on. And I had a younger brother who was sort of 2 years younger than me and not really able to understand it as well as I could. So I'd be trying to go to bed at night, and I'd be awakened by screaming and yelling and things being thrown, and I'd go downstairs and I'd kind of peek around the corner and try to figure out what was going on. And intervene if necessary, to break them up or to mediate and try to say, you know, what's this about, and literally negotiate. I had no idea at the time that those would be skills that I'd have to use later in life, but it was a really formative experience because it taught me, one, to be resilient and to not let something as painful and destructive as a breakup of your family cause me never to be able to fulfill my potential. But so resilience was one thing, but also, you know, recognizing that being a firefighter, getting in between, you know, warring parties was something that maybe I had an early faculty for.
Yeah. And after that, you were a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and then spent some time in the private sector, I think working for McKinsey and Company, before 1992, when the Clinton transition team asks you to join the NSC as, I believe, Director of International Organizations and Peacekeeping. That position then puts you right in the middle of back-to-back crises, the civil war in Somalia and the Rwandan genocide. As someone who was brand new to government service, that has to have been a real baptism of fire for you.
It was exactly that. That's the right way to put it, a baptism by fire. And there are other elements of that baptism that I don't even have the opportunity to get into in the book, like Bosnia, like Haiti. But I write at length about Somalia and Rwanda because they shaped me very profoundly. Black Hawk Down and the fact that Congress, after we lost 18 Americans in a horrific attack on our personnel in Mogadishu required the administration to withdraw all U.S. military personnel by within 6 months. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
and a lot of the blame for that fell on him. It was presented as if the president was the one who was cutting and running.
Yeah, President Clinton was accused of cutting and running, but it was Congress that mandated that he cut and run, if that's mm-hmm. the term you want to use.
Yeah.
And then 7 days after the last American serviceman was evacuated from Somalia, we had the beginning of the genocide in Rwanda. And I write at some length about that as well, because the experience of visiting Rwanda after the genocide and seeing
yeah.
bodies, corpses just still thick on the ground, and also, you know, watching as a junior staffer, as you know, the decision-making process at the National Security Council really failed to grapple with the question of whether or not the United States could intervene to try to halt the genocide, or whether we ought to help others to intervene, or any of these questions were never asked, much less answered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned a lot, both from the experience of Somalia and Rwanda, about how the decision-making process can fail. Those were lessons, as well as, you know, the mm-hmm. challenge of how do you deal with humanitarian crises, that I took with me later into my career, as I served in the Obama administration at the UN and as National Security mm-hmm. Advisor.
The way you've just phrased it, it sounds like you see it as it was more a case of the administration didn't really know if they had the authority to intervene, right?
No, it wasn't whether they had the authority.
Okay.
Now we're getting into a lot of complexity. But
okay.
The point I was making was nobody in government in Washington, nobody in the Congress, no editorial page writers were grappling with the question of whether or not the United States should intervene to deal with
okay.
the genocide. So this was a case where the policy process failed because mm-hmm. we didn't even, you know, ask and answer the issue at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do it in large part because I think people were still traumatized by Somalia. It never occurred to people, frankly, to contemplate another massive military intervention in an even more remote part of Africa after we'd basically had this humiliating retreat from Somalia. So
okay.
Somalia, the problem was, you know, multiple, but we didn't pay enough attention
right.
to what was going on the ground. That's a summary statement.
Right. And it wasn't a problem that you guys started.
No,
inherited that.
Exactly. We inherited. Know. Rwanda, the failure in my judgment was that we didn't even consider the question of whether or not to engage in terms of trying to stop the killing.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not we needed UN Security Council authorization, that would have been a question we would have asked and answered after a decision that
okay.
we wanted to do something.
Okay.
But it we didn't even get to that
yeah.
point.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. Now, you described the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania as the hardest moment of your life. Walk us through those first 24 hours from your perspective.
It was horrible. I mean, first of all, I start in describing this in Tough Love with the night before the bombings. And I'm relatively new in the job of Assistant Secretary of State for
right.
African Affairs. I'm 32 years old. I'm a breastfeeding mom in a department where most of the people who report to me are 20 to 30 years my elders and predominantly white men. And we're struggling already with a rash of crises that have broken out. War between Ethiopia and Eritrea, war in the Congo, evacuations being required in Liberia. I mean, it's like I could go through a litany about six or seven things that were all crushing in on us at the same time. And that night before the embassy bombings, I had dinner with my former boss, the former National Security Advisor, Anthony Lake. And I was describing to him all these things that were going on and how it felt like a crushing amount of pressure. And he said to me, rather than offering me comfort, "It can always get worse." And I was like, "Great, thanks." So we said goodbye, go to bed. 4 a.m, my phone rings. It's the State Department Operations Center waking me up to tell me that there'd been 2 simultaneous explosions at our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and there were lots and lots of casualties. And I, you know, obviously jump out of bed, in and out of the shower and on my way to the State Department within about 10 or 15 minutes to have to confront the reality that we had lost 12 Americans in Kenya, over 200 Kenyans killed, and thousands grievously wounded. Our embassy was, you know, leveled. And similarly in Tanzania, but unfortunately we didn't lose Americans in Tanzania. It was horrible. And the pressure, you know, on all sides, dealing with the counterterrorism challenge, dealing with the families of those who had loved ones in our embassies, dealing with the embassies on the ground, which were, you know, struggling to just get information.
I can imagine.
That was really the worst period of my professional life. And as bad as it was for me, it's nothing like it was, obviously, for the people who lost their loved ones and for my colleagues who served in those embassies.
Well, one of your recurring nemeses in this book, both during the Clinton and Obama administrations, is Ambassador Richard Holbrook. He had a reputation for being famously gruff and ill-tempered. You describe him as a bully. What was his problem with you?
Well, I do describe him as a bully, and I don't shy from that characterization. He was also a skilled diplomat, but he was very much about himself. Mm-hmm. And the my first experience with him came as I was in this job as Assistant Secretary of State. He had just been or recently been nominated to become the UN ambassador. And I am on Capitol Hill in a series of meetings with members of Congress, and my assistant calls. And she says, Ambassador Holbrook is in your office, and he's demanding that you come back to meet with him. I said, why is he in my office? And tell him I'm on the Hill, I'm meeting with members of Congress. I can't meet with him now. Schedule an appointment. And she says, he's not leaving. And I said, well, you know, make sure he doesn't steal anything. Watch him. I'll come back when my meetings are over. So about an hour and a half later or so, I get back to the State Department, and there he is sitting on the couch in my office. And I, again, never met him before. I knew all about him. His reputation preceded him. And I said to him, so what's so urgent that you're sitting here waiting for me on my couch? And I sit down, and he says, I already dislike you because you've broken my record as the youngest regional assistant secretary. And our relationship went downhill from there.
What an ego.
I think he found me to be insufficiently admiring or deferential. Uh-huh. More than willing to say what I think, which is true about me, and not taking crap off of him, mm-hmm. as my dad taught me.
Yeah, at one point you flip him off in a meeting, right?
Exactly. At one point when he's trying to humiliate me and condescend to me as we were having an argument in front of six or seven of my... of the ambassadors who reported to me, he said to me, dripping with sarcasm and condescension when he was trying to disagree, I remember when I, too, was a young assistant secretary, just basically
very
telling me to go crawl under a rock.
Yeah.
And so failing to find the words quickly enough to express my feelings, I raised my arm and then my middle finger, and held it up long enough for him to understand what I was trying to say.
Well, I want to fast forward to the 2008 election. Your next logical move would have been for you to stay within the Clinton camp and support and advise Hillary Clinton's campaign for president. Instead, you joined the Obama team. How did you make that decision, and how did the Clinton team take that news?
Well, I came to know and admire Barack Obama beginning in 2004 when he was running for the Senate. And I was working on John Kerry's presidential campaign. That's when we first interacted. Mm-hmm. And then when he won the Senate seat and came to Washington, I got to know him quite a bit better and advised him and developed a rapport with him. And when he made it clear that he was going to run for president, I decided that I wanted to be all in supporting him. Not because I didn't love and respect my time in the Clinton administration and respect President Clinton and Senator Clinton, but because for me, Obama represented so much more. I mean, mm-hmm. he was an African-American leader of my generation. He was smart. He was principled. He had a vision for this country that I thought was forward-looking and unifying. And it was on that basis, just being drawn to who he was and what his election could symbolize, that I made the decision to support him. And then, unexpectedly, after I made that decision, I got a phone call from another former boss of mine named Sandy Berger, who had also been in Clinton's second term, the National Security Advisor, and he was a friend. And he said that Senator Clinton would like me to coordinate her foreign policy apparatus, essentially the same role I was playing for Obama. And I said, Sandy, you know, I've already signed up with Obama. And it wasn't that he had called too late. It was that I'd made this decision perfectly witting of the fact that, you know, at some point the Clintons were going to know this and not appreciate it. But I did it because it was the right choice for me. And so then he says, but you realize he's not going to win, right? And I said, you know, I don't know whether he's going to win, but I recognize that that's the betting man's point of view. And he says, you know, this is a career-ending move. If, you know, when he loses, you're going to be screwed, in effect. And he's telling me this as a friend. And I said, Sandy, I get that, but I'm doing this not for a job, but because this is really important to me. And that was the end of the conversation. We stayed friends, and it was all good. But, you know, the bottom line is that there were a number of people like me who'd served in the Clinton administration who chose to sign up with Obama early. Mm-hmm. And I do think it was for quite a while a sore spot mm-hmm. with the loyalists of the Clintons.
And yet, once he got elected, President Obama appoints you UN ambassador. And then I think right after he offers you the job, he says, what do you think about Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State?
Exactly.
And that's you said she was a good choice.
I did. I said, if you would do that, I think it would be a good choice. Mm-hmm. And so then we worked together closely for 4 years.
You then played an instrumental role in the U.S. intervention against Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. How much of that was influenced by this haunting memory of Rwanda and the cost of inaction?
Well, in my mind, at this point, with more years of experience and hopefully some wisdom acquired along the way, my calculation was we had an opportunity to intervene at a relatively low cost to the United States. It wasn't going to require ground forces. We could do it through the air, and we could prevent Gaddafi from slaughtering tens of thousands of civilians, which was his stated intention, and his forces were on the way to do it. So that was relatively low risk and high reward in terms of what it would accomplish in humanitarian terms. And we also had the support of NATO and the Arab countries, and we obtained the support of the United Nations. When I was ambassador, I led that effort. And so in my mind, the cost-benefit analysis argued in favor of intervention. And I still think that was the right thing to do. But I made clear that, you know, the problem, the failure, was really in the aftermath, where the United States and NATO and the African Union and the Arab countries and the UN failed to act swiftly to try to help consolidate the institutions of the state in a fractured society in Libya after Gaddafi was removed. Mm-hmm. He was the state, and in his absence, it was sort of close to chaos.
Yeah.
And so what we ideally would have done is put sustained effort and attention with the international community into trying to consolidate the post-conflict situation. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do it with sufficient attention and urgency. And then Benghazi happened.
Right.
And everybody in Washington sort of recoiled even further from Libya. Yeah. And I say in the book, you know, Libya was so fractured a society, I don't know that if we had been 100% effective in our efforts that it would have worked.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do say is we don't know because we weren't able to try.
Yeah, I mean, professionally for you, maybe it would have been better if you'd left him in power.
No.
You wouldn't have had to
no.
deal with
No, and it's
all
not
that.
About me. I will take saving tens of thousands of lives any day.
Well, still, the Benghazi attack happens September 11th, 2012, and you get convinced to do what they call the full Ginsburg.
Asked, and I accepted.
Okay, which means doing all five of the Sunday morning shows. You were the person who was assigned to articulate the Obama administration's account of what happened. This was not really in your portfolio. You were UN ambassador, and there were arguably other people who were more directly involved and better equipped to speak to what happened. Yet you became the face of the controversy. Did you have any idea what you were walking into?
Well, Ben, really, what happened was the White House called me on a Friday late afternoon before the Sunday shows, and they said, you know, we've asked Secretary Clinton if she'll do it. We haven't heard back from her, but if she says no, would you be willing to do it? And then they call back later, and they say she said no. Would you do it? And I said, you know, this is not how I'd planned to spend my weekend. I was planning to take my kids to the Ohio State football game in Columbus, but if nobody else is available and you need somebody to do it, I'll do it. And so, to be honest, I wasn't thinking in terms of myself. I was thinking in terms of we've, as a team, as a country, we've suffered an extraordinary tragedy. We also had a lot of other issues going on as in demonstrations and protests against our embassies elsewhere in the Arab and Muslim world. The UN General Assembly, which is the big annual gathering of the heads of state, where the UN ambassador is front and center, was coming up in about 10 days, and we were dealing with issues of Syria and Israel and Iran. And so it wasn't completely crazy to ask me to do it, but ideally somebody else would have stepped up. But when asked, my instinct has always been to be a team player. Mm-hmm. And so I said yes, reluctantly. And then I went to look in on my mom, who had been very ill. She'd recently had her fourth or fifth cancer surgery and suffered a stroke. And I went by her house just to say hello and spend some time with her before I got home. And she asked me what I was doing for the weekend. And I said, you know, I'm going to Ohio State, but I also just agreed to go on the Sunday shows. And she's like, why? Why you? Why not Hillary? And then she kept going, smell a rat. And I'm like, Mom, don't be ridiculous. I've done this before. It's going to be fine. And of course, it wasn't.
Never doubt mother's intuition.
Exactly. So the lesson, the primary lesson of this episode is always listen to your mother.
Yeah.
But she perceived what I didn't in retrospect, which is that whoever's out there in a hot conflict situation, in a political hothouse, delivering a message, it's likely that the messenger is going to be attacked as much as the message. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And speaking of the toll this takes on the family, apparently it also had, I imagine, what at the time must have seemed like a pretty frightening impact on your own young daughter. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. And it was, you know, so in the wake of my Sunday show appearances, I became targeted as a liar, as incompetent, as untrustworthy. All these things were the sustained Republican talking points against me. And it was pretty intense and interminable for many weeks. And in the course of the weeks following it, my daughter came to me and my husband. She was 9 years old at the time. And she was complaining that she was seeing images of men coming out of walls at her.
Wow.
And first we were like, kind of skeptical, and then she kept repeating it, and we realized that she was having, in effect, hallucinations. So obviously we took her to get a battery of tests at Children's Hospital, and over 2 weeks they were looking to try to figure out, you know, does she have a brain tumor? Is there some kind of psychosis or schizophrenia? Does she have a visual impairment? And we went through all these different worst-case scenarios, and they fortunately, over a period of a couple of weeks, were able to rule them out. Meanwhile, we're terrified, you know, about what could be going on with her. She'd been, you know, totally happy and healthy up until that point. And once they ruled out all the worst-case scenarios, they essentially concluded that in all likelihood she was having a stress reaction to what had been happening to me. And we realized that, you know, we had the television on for too much of this. We were tuning it out, but our daughter wasn't necessarily able to tune it out and couldn't understand it really at that age. And so she was internalizing this stuff. So I write about that in the book, not only because it was a pretty heavy experience for me and my husband, but more importantly, I wanted to convey that when we have the politics of personal destruction in Washington, which happens, you know, irrespective of party affiliation, the victims are not only the people who are targeted, but even more so the people who love the person who's being targeted. So my daughter, my mother also suffered a great deal, and to a lesser extent, others in my family. And my point is that this politics of personal destruction don't come for free, and we ought to be mindful of that.
And I think that you say that our greatest national security threat is actually the political divisions that we're having within our own country right now.
That is exactly what I say, and I believe it fervently. You know, we are at risk of losing our national cohesion and losing our democracy because of these divisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are preventing us from doing basic stuff like making investments in our infrastructure, in technology so that we can compete with China. But it's also giving our adversaries like Russia a big opening to pour salt into our wounds and, you know, cause us to doubt each other, to hate each other, to see one another as enemies rather than as fellow Americans. And I write about how that is a huge challenge, but I also talk about how we have overcome so many more moments of division and disunity in our country that were worse than this, from the Civil War, you know, through McCarthyism to Vietnam and the Civil Rights era. And I really believe we have the ability, if we have the will, to repair these divisions now. But it has to happen on every level, from the individual and the interpersonal. As I share in my book, I've got a very conservative son and a very progressive daughter. And I'm sitting in the middle with my husband at the dinner table trying to, you know, keep things from flying across the table. In the same vein, at an institutional and a national level, we have to take steps that I propose in the book that can help to bridge those divides and enable us to heal.
Well, another thing that comes up in the book that I kind of found an amusing revelation, you say that no call with Vladimir Putin is short. I guess at times he would keep President Obama on the phone for 60, maybe even 90 minutes. What is he like in a one-on-one conversation?
Well, Putin is tedious and self-important. And, you know, on these phone calls, which were meant to deal with substantive issues, and that rarely lasted less than 90 minutes, in part because there was translation on both sides, but also because Putin's long-winded and you know, self-important. They were dealing with issues of difference, like Ukraine, for example, or Syria. And the conversations were actually relatively civil and respectful, even where we differed. But they didn't yield a great deal. But I had also a lot of experience with Putin one-on-one and personally.
Right. And you said he was a creep, right?
He's a creep. He's a creep. When I was at a gathering in Normandy in 2014, where a lot of Western leaders were there to commemorate the Normandy invasion, we were in a reception and President Obama was far across the room. And it was just he and I as Americans in the room. And I was in a conversation with Putin's national security advisor, and Putin comes up, and he's talking, and he basically puckers his lips and blows me a kiss. And he says to his national security advisor, "She's quite beautiful for a national security advisor." And, you know, just gross.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you would imagine, you know, misogynistic and condescending. So that was... that was one of my many interactions with Putin.
Yeah, I hear that. I want to say that he had some kind of a similar reaction to your predecessor, Condoleezza Rice, too.
I can't speak for her, and I don't know, have a similar story on her behalf to relate, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, before we go, I just have to ask about something Alyssa Mastromonaco told me a few months ago. She says that you are known to throw down on the dance floor and have some wicked dance moves. I won't ask for a demo right now, but... where do you get your dance skills from, and do you have a signature move?
I, you know what? I love to dance. And of all the things that I can possibly hope to do when I feel like, you know, we're under stress or things are getting heavy, it's having a good throwdown. And so I got lots of moves, and I'm not going to call out one over the other. Okay. But I do write in the book about the last night of the last presidential trip overseas. In 2016, after Trump had won, we're in Lima, Peru, and all of the traveling Obama team, minus the president, go out to a nightclub. And one thing the Obama team know how to do is to party. And we had a party to end all parties with tons of dancing and tons of Pisco Sours. And I had to get up early the next morning to join the president in his meetings. The rest of the folks, many of them were able to sleep in. And, you know, I'd had too much to drink, and I'd done way too many low moves on the dance floor. And when I got out of bed, my knees buckled, and I could barely get to the shower. But that was how we rolled, and, you know, that's sort of indicative of how I love to dance and what I've done to torture my body in the process.
Little did you know it would be a 3 or 4 year hangover now.
So. Oh, my gosh.
Well, again, Susan Rice's book is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Susan Rice, it's been such a pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks again to Susan Rice for coming on the show. Order her new book, Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.